this is not a pep rally at Notre Dame.
We're fine, everybody. That's
the president says we're fine. Barack Obama speaks at Notre Dame's commencement, and anti-abortion hecklers disrupt the proceedings. The student body shouts down the hecklers, and in general, a good time was had by all.
We're fine, everybody.
So fine on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everybody. It's Monday, May 18th. I'm John Hockenberry, joined by our very own...
Just keep chasing pavements.
You know her. She chases pavements all over America, but she's here in the studio. The Takeaway's Andrea Bernstein. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, we'll bring you the agenda, The Takeaway's Monday morning roadmap to all the big news you need to understand this week, plus storm chasing with a purpose. You'll meet a meteorologist who's diving into tornadoes, trying to figure out where they'll strike next. These stories and plenty more coming up, but first these headlines.
And in the headlines, the story to watch in Washington this morning is President Obama's first meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. That's in a couple of hours. The Obama administration strongly backs an independent Palestinian state alongside Israel. Not so Netanyahu, at least not publicly. But keep an eye on his position over the weekend. His defense minister said Netanyahu may soon back a two-state plan. Notre Dame parents got a good show on Sunday, a front-row seat to a national political controversy starring Barack Obama. Abortion foes attacked the Catholic school for inviting a pro-choice leader to speak. The president took on the issue in his speech. He wants people on both sides to respect each other.
Each side will continue to make its case to the public with passion and conviction. But surely we can do so without reducing those with differing views to caricature.
More on that speech and the political significance of it later on in the program. Andrea?
The trial of pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi is underway at a prison in Myanmar, the Asian nation also known as Burma. Myanmar's military government charges her with violating house arrest terms after an American man swam to her lakeside home. Her lawyers say she has no connection to the visitor, and military rulers are just using it as an excuse to keep her locked up. Elsewhere in Asia, Sri Lanka's government claims the leader of the Tamil Tiger rebels is dead. The army says troops defeated the rebels in the country's north, killing the leader along with the top deputies. Reporters are barred from the war zone, so there's no confirmation of the military's claim. Tamil rebels have fought the government for a quarter century. Government troops gained the upper hand in recent months.
An oil refinery fire on the Delaware River is now under control. A Sunoco facility along the Pennsylvania-Delaware border rattled nearby homes when it blew up last night. There are apparently no injuries. The company says workers are all accounted for and local air is safe to breathe. In Asian markets, the action was in India. Key index there rocketed up 17%, forcing a halt in trading for the day. Hong Kong and South Korean markets posted gains, and on Wall Street this morning, the Dow starts at 8268. The S&P begins trading at 882. Scientists believe perhaps half of all the species on Earth will be gone by the end of the century. Which species are you most worried about going away?
The species I'm most worried about disappearing is the overzealous, out-for-myself Republican, because then John Stewart would have no one to make fun of.
Biology or politics? Tell us your view on mass extinction at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. It's the beginning of the week, folks.
Hey, what's happening?
Our government.
Bailout.
Your government.
Energy resources.
Healthcare.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Global financial recession.
The work that needs to be done.
What's going on? I'm John Hockenberry here with Andrea Bernstein in the studio. And on a Monday morning, we want to set your agenda by talking about the events in Washington and around the world coming this week. Earlier this morning, we spoke to our good friend Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. And in the interest of symmetry, we spoke with Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our other partners, the BBC. He joined us from London. We began with a very big story. Pelosi versus the CIA. We've heard from Nancy Pelosi that the CIA lied to her on those CIA so-called torture briefings. Today, we may hear from Leon Panetta on the subject. And when we spoke earlier this morning, I asked Marcus Mabry to explain what we're likely to see.
Well, we can expect this, you know, she said, they said, to continue this week with poor Leon Panetta, really, you know, the director of the Central Intelligence, caught in the middle. He really has not. He's back to his agency. He's tried not to call Nancy Pelosi a liar per se, but with her calling the CIA liars, he kind of doesn't have much of a choice. And it looked like initially a few weeks ago when this first came up that maybe she'd be able to say, as she tried to say initially, well, you know, they told me this might happen, but they didn't tell me these enhanced interrogation techniques, quote unquote, were actually going on. And they said that's not true.
Well, here's Nancy Pelosi speaking last week.
They mislead us all the time. I was fighting the war in Iraq at that point, too, you know, saying to my members, the intelligence does not support the imminent threat that they are conceding. But what's the point? Yeah, they did. They misrepresented every step of the way.
Even though she sounds rattled, she's very clear. Does Leon Panetta, when he delivers his first public speech today, have to address this?
He doesn't have to in the speech. It's actually, depending on what kind of media follow-up there'll be, if there's Q&A, then he will have no choice but to address it because the media will make him. But it's interesting. The irony of this, of course, is the fact this week we'll see Nancy Pelosi staying on the hot seat, even though, of course, you know, she was not running the government.
Right, exactly, exactly. The policy issue that really comes to the fore early on this week is a proposal in Washington that will actually get debated on how to regulate the derivatives market, given that we've spent much of the last year talking about how it's impossible to even price these things. How can you come up with a regime to regulate them?
Well, this is key, John. This is incredibly important. It'll be interesting to watch this week. What we want to watch on the agenda this week is what comes out of the two different congressional committees that would have oversight. There's a debate over whether or not this would be the Commodities Futures Trading Commission or whether this would be the SEC. They'll be regulating this. But the two-page letter that Secretary Geithner sent last week up to the Hill says that the administration wants to be able to regulate and to make sure these things are traded publicly and transparently, which did not happen before. And we're talking about, you know, more than half, well, we're talking more than $600 trillion worth of derivatives that were floating around a year ago, all privately placed with no one knowing where they were or what they're based upon. That is what led to the financial crisis last year that led to the economic crisis that we are still enduring.
So speaking of financial crises, President Obama has yet another wish this week. Is he going to get it?
Now, you should not have to worry that when you sign up for a credit card, you're signing away all your rights. You shouldn't need a magnifying glass or a law degree to read the fine print that sometimes don't even appear to be written in English or Spanish.
Going to get his wish?
Yes, he will get his wish. There's no question about it. When the House version of the credit card regulations legislation was voted on, even Republicans voted for it. It's something that's overwhelmingly positive up on the Hill. It's going to be interesting to see the Senate version comes up for vote tomorrow, probably. How many Republicans will back it? It's a little different from the House version, but both of them kind of take down these kind of onerous, some would say, despicable charges that can be.
Some say it every month when they open their bill. Yeah,
absolutely.
This is a real sea change. I mean, for a decade, more than a decade, the financial
amazing.
Industry resisted regulation on credit cards and derivatives, and now poof, it's going to turn around.
What a difference a financial crisis will make.
No kidding.
Yeah,
right.
But the credit card thing, I mean, everybody sees it as the banks are getting a big break, so why am I not?
Well, it's ironic, though, because this could be an unforeseen reality of this. Since the banks will no longer be able to do lots of kind of predatory lending that they do to people under 21, for instance, and to people who actually have revolving balances who don't pay off all their cards, those of us who pay off our cards every cycle could now see our set fees, things like the annual fee, rocket up. And things like like points and benefits disappear completely.
So we'll get slapped for being good.
Absolutely.
Well, on the international agenda, Benjamin Netanyahu is set to visit Barack Obama in Washington today to discuss the Middle East and to discuss his own sort of questionable leadership in Israel. Jonathan Marcus, Netanyahu's first meeting with Barack Obama, is he on the defensive or is this someone with a message to send, do you think?
Well, both sides have been sending lots of strong signals in advance of this meeting. I think it's very clear the Americans, this is an administration that is preparing to set out a comprehensive peace plan for the region. It's going to continue strongly backing Israel's security and the existence of a Jewish state, but it also is going to expect Israel to do its part in furthering a peace agreement. Now, the crucial thing there is, of course, a two-state solution, which President Obama has made explicitly clear is something that is in America's national interest. That's not quite the way Mr. Netanyahu sees it. As yet, he hasn't been willing to say that magic phrase, a two-state solution. He's no doubt going to be wanting to stall. A lot of people have talked about a train wreck in Israel-US relations. That's not going to happen at this meeting. I think they're going to be smiles all round. It's very much a preliminary session, but I think both men will go away with a much clearer understanding of where the other is coming from.
But Jonathan, there is a collision course here. It seems that the momentum in both the Washington and around the world is to move quickly to final status issues in talking about the Middle East. And I don't know if Netanyahu is capable of delivering that. What do you think?
Well, we don't know that. What's clear is that Mr. Netanyahu has been flexible in the past when he's had to be. It's interesting that opinion polls in Israel, even amongst Likud supporters, the conservative supporters of the Prime Minister, suggest that good relations with the United States are paramount in their minds. Israel, of course, has another major problem on its hands, the perceived threat from Iran's nuclear program. And if things go badly there, it's going to need the Americans firmly in Israel's corner. So good relations with Washington are essential. It's clear that many in Israel, whatever their political views, do believe that ultimately a two-state solution is the only answer to the problems of the region. Now, whether President Obama's bold and audacious attempt at the outset of his presidency to try and get this peace show back on the road is going to succeed, who knows? But I think it's going to be very difficult for the Israelis if they very quickly and very early are seen to be principal obstacles to that path.
Jonathan, speaking of relationships with Washington, Russia and the U.S. are beginning talks today in Moscow about replacing a treaty on curbing nuclear arms, which expires in December. We've got the START Treaty Redux back up there with the ketchup as a vegetable, taxi driver, a bit of a blast from the past. What can we expect?
It is kind of a blast from the past in a way. I mean, it's like back to the old days of the Cold War, the two apparent superpowers sitting down at the nuclear negotiating table talking about arms cuts. I think clearly both sides, in Moscow and in Washington, want to improve ties between them. We've heard a lot of talk from the Americans of pressing the restart button and so on. Now, there are lots of very, very difficult and contentious issues between them, and I'm not sure it's all going to be sweet and light. But paradoxically, one of the easier issues to deal with is this question of nuclear arms. This is how things have changed since the Cold War, when this was clearly one of the most difficult issues on the table. Both sides, for different reasons, want a new arms control agreement. The Russians, because it emphasizes their role as a sort of key interlocutor with the Americans. They sit side by side. Everybody else is excluded. That's good for the Russians' self-image. Also, if they can cut their nuclear arsenal, that will save them some money. For Mr. Obama, there are huge benefits in a new arms deal, not least that he is eager to burnish America's non-proliferation credentials. He's very eager to bolster and buttress the international non-proliferation machinery. And one way of doing that is to convince other countries around the world that America is indeed serious about reducing its own nuclear stockpile.
So, as long as they're hitting the restart button rather than any of those other buttons there in the nuclear stockpile. Quickly, before we go, the Iranian election campaign officially begins. Jonathan, quickly, and I want to get a comment from Marcus. It's beginning on a warm note with the release of Roxana Saberi, the journalist.
Well, indeed, although perhaps if they hadn't locked her up in the first place, that would have been an even warmer note. It's crucially interesting, of course, because we have this initiative by the Obama administration reach out to the Iranians. It's not clear very much is going to happen until after this election. So being watched in Washington carefully and indeed around the world.
Marcus Mabry, take us out.
It's going to be interesting to see if it's a fair and free election. That's going to be the most interesting thing about it.
And if there's any challenger for Ahmadinejad. Thank you, Marcus Mabry, international business editor for The New York Times. And thanks to Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our partners at the BBC, for that interview conducted earlier this morning. And there's your agenda.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning on this Monday morning. I'm John Hockenberry with Andrea Bernstein. In the current New Yorker, Elizabeth Colbert writes about a scientific consensus that perhaps half of the species on Earth could be gone by the end of this century, part of a mass extinction. Which species are you most worried about going away?
And I'm worried about the extinction of redheads. I'm thinking maybe if I could find a guy with red hair that he and I could have babies and keep the redheads alive, because I hear they're going to be extinct before you know it.
If you have a more serious response to a mass extinction here on planet Earth, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. But any comments on redheads are certainly welcome. Andrea?
There is a mystery. Elusive. Unpredictable. Violent. It terrifies most scientists. But for a new breed, the challenge is saving lives. The research is deadly.
That's from the 1996 movie Twister, about brave scientists who chase tornadoes for the good of humanity. Today we're talking with a real-life tornado chaser, Dr. Katja Friedrich. She's a meteorologist at the University of Colorado's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, who is one of nearly 100 scientists working on the largest ever field experiment in the Plains States to study tornadoes in order to learn how to predict when one might hit next. Welcome, Katja.
Good morning.
So you're not spooked?
Not really.
So this is not the movies. This is real life. Three people unfortunately died last week. How dangerous are tornadoes, and are they getting more deadly?
Actually, tornadoes are very dangerous, although we have to say that, really getting hit by a tornado is a very, very rare occasion, because it's a very small feature. It's not very long-lived, and so you have to be very, very unfortunate to get hit by a tornado. Nevertheless, it does hit small towns and houses, and people get died and injured.
So that movie Twister, I remember, featured, flying cars and people hiding under bridges. And we're catching you after the first week of your tornado-chasing six-week project. What is it that you're looking for, and what's it like out there?
Generally, we are looking, it's very interesting because we are not very far ahead in our research. We are still trying to understand very basic features. So why do tornadoes form? How do they form? How strong are they getting? What are the features that actually intensifying these tornadoes? So these are the main things. And what we are trying to do is just to improve the warnings or the forecast. So give people, instead of 8-10 minutes, give them a few more minutes to seek shelter and save their properties. So right now we've been in week two. It's not we've had two intersections and we did not really see a tornado. So that's what I'm saying. It's very unlikely that you actually see a tornado and that you intercept the tornado. It's very, very difficult.
So what are you doing? Driving around and looking for disturbances in the atmosphere? I mean, what's the daily life of a tornado chaser like?
So usually we start with weather analysis, and that's very complicated. We have to make up our mind in the morning where we are going. So usually we are looking for disturbances where it's very likely that tornadoes form. Then usually we drive out and we are watching the radar images and see if there are any supercells that develop along some lines. And so it's a huge difference if you go out alone or if you have a fleet of 50 to 60 cars that you have to organize. So usually if we see these supercells...
That's what you have? 50 to 60 cars?
That's what we have, yes. This is a very, very big experiment. So, and then we are trying to organize these people along these supercells so they can actually take measurements. And then we have to stick with one of these thunderstorms, and we have to hope that one of these thunderstorms are actually forming a tornado.
What are the signatures you're looking for? Is it temperature? Is it precipitation? What?
Usually we look look at the Doppler the radar images, and we are looking for signature in the radar reflectivity. So usually a very distinct signature is our rotation, or is this called hook echo, which is like a comma shape signature in the radar reflectivity.
So do you feel disappointed at the end of a day if you haven't seen that, or do you feel relieved?
Since our objective is to measure tornadoes, we are sometimes a little bit disappointed if we don't see any tornadoes. However, all kind of measurements are interesting because, as I said, we don't really know why some thunderstorms form tornadoes where others do not form tornadoes. They even have measurements within supercells that do not form a tornado. It's actually very valuable to the project.
Why is it so hard to predict a tornado?
Because these features are occurring for probably just a few minutes, they're very small, and it's very dangerous, and we didn't really have the equipment to go close and do the measurements. So we are really lacking information of general temperature, pressure within the vicinity of a tornado.
What if at the end of your experiment, Katya, you discover that they're like snowflakes? Everyone is different, and there's really no way to predict.
Maybe we don't find a way to predict, but generally, as I said, I mean, we are trying even the warning to increase this from 8 minutes to 10 minutes, and people are looking at me. I mean, really, really trying to get to gain more two more minutes, but that's actually what we do.
That's good, 2 extra minutes? I mean, that will really save lives?
Yes, I mean, some people have more time to seek shelter. And also you have to remember that there are major cities within the, what we call Tornado Alley. There's Dallas, and even Chicago is at the edge of Tornado Alley. So these people would really appreciate if they have 2 more minutes.
What are you going to be doing for the next 5 weeks? Driving around with these same 60 cars every day? Hoping you're not disappointed?
Every day in a different hotel. So we are driving around from Texas up to North Dakota and trying to look for tornadoes and trying to intercept any tornadoes that we can find.
All right. Well, good luck to you. We'll be watching for the results of your research.
It's a lot of driving. A lot of Mexican food.
Yes, fast food. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was Dr. Katya Friedrich, meteorologist in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the University of Colorado. Time for headlines with Femi Okeh.
Thank you. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Now, in a couple of hours, President Obama meets with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and this will be their first meeting. The leaders disagree on a number of issues, including U.S. diplomacy with Israel's foes and the president's support for the creation of an independent Palestinian state. But over the weekend, Netanyahu's defense minister said that he may shift his stance and back a two-state plan. President Obama was in the middle of another controversy yesterday when he gave the graduation address at Notre Dame. Amid protests, he used the platform to talk about abortion. Protesters interrupted the president's speech and 37 people were arrested for trespassing. The U.S. airline industry estimates that 14 million fewer people will fly this summer than last summer. That's about 7% drop. That's according to the Air Transportation Association. But airlines have cut flights, so planes will probably seem as full as ever. And while on the subject of transport, the average price for a gallon of gas in the U.S. went up around about 25 cents in the last 3 weeks. And that's according to the Lomberg survey. And that is a look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. I've noticed the gas rising.
Yeah?
You actually noticed it, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Very good.
Very good. It's not pleasant.
It's good you're attentive.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
America must play its role in ushering in a new era of peace. To the Muslim world, we seek a new way forward, based on mutual interest and mutual respect.
Hopeful words from President Obama during his inaugural address talking about the Middle East. But exactly what where on the priority list the Middle East falls, we're likely to get some hints today. Today, the president meets for the first time since he took office with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to talk about the significance of this meeting and the momentum behind Middle East peace at this stage of the Obama administration is Aaron David Miller, former advisor on the Middle East to both Republican and Democratic secretaries of state, former Middle East negotiator at the State Department, and he's the author of The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. We're pleased to welcome Aaron David Miller back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
It seems to me, looking at some of the Israeli press on Netanyahu's meeting today, that he's a bit on the defensive, coming from some very difficult budget negotiations in the Knesset, and that he's facing some probably difficult challenges in attempting to make his case to Barack Obama. What's your view?
Well, there's no question about that. In fact, the media has portrayed this meeting as a meeting between President Yes We Can and Prime Minister No You Won't. And that notion that we're headed for a confrontation, it seems to me, provides the background for this meeting. I don't think it will be the case, at least not now. Neither man wants a fight. Neither man is ready for a fight. And frankly, given the intractable nature of the problems on the table, Iran and the pursuit of Arab-Israeli peace, neither Netanyahu nor Obama have strategies in place yet to push this to a decision point.
So, Aaron David Miller, the momentum that we're seeing on the outside could work against as well as possibly for peace. I'm speaking of the fact that President Obama has already met with King Abdullah of Jordan, and there's been already talk about the Saudi proposal for moving to final status issues. There's momentum for discussions between Israel and Syria. But if Netanyahu doesn't want to go to final status talks and instead wants to focus on incremental issues, this could all go away.
Well, you're right. That's clearly not going to work. But most of what you described is at least at this stage, process. The real question is there a conflict-ending agreement on the core issues between the Israelis and the Palestinians, on borders, Jerusalem, security, and refugees? And is there prospects for, are there prospects for an Israeli-Syrian agreement? These are decisions that need to be confronted honestly and openly. And neither the president nor the prime minister in May of 2009, frankly, are ready to confront them. The real issue for today's meeting is trust. Frankly, the absence of it. Netanyahu comes to Washington with a reputation, and I suspect that reputation is being fed by some of the president's advisors who point to his earlier performance and behavior during the Clinton administration. And there's no question that Netanyahu is not sure what to make of President Obama. He's new. He's potentially transformative. He looks at the world in a much more even-tempered, fair manner when it comes to Israeli and Palestinian needs. The question is, given all this baggage and given the difficulty of the issues on the table, can these two guys work out some kind of relationship to actually make progress on both the Iranian issue and on the Arab-Israeli one? And frankly, right now, that's not clear, and it's not going to become much clearer, it seems to me, in the immediate aftermath of this meeting.
Now, what about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton? She was a senator from New York. She had a position on Israel that was seen to be very sort of pro-Israel. To what extent are her views going to be influencing these talks?
I think if this process turns into more than just discussions and leads to real negotiations, that it is the Secretary of State that will and must take the key role, the key lead. This is one very smart and, I think, very tough lady. And whatever her views on the Israelis and on pro-Israeli domestic politics in the United States in her role as senator, even as first lady, whatever those views, she's now in a new role. And frankly, the most important objective for her right now, and she knows it, is how to succeed, how to become a consequential Secretary of State. She may well decide that this is an issue that's worth her time and her commitment. And if she's backed up by a president, in this case Barack Obama, who wants to see this happen, at least on the American side, there's the real possibility of progress. The problem here is not Washington. The problem is whether or not Israelis and Palestinians in this environment can actually reach an agreement on issues such as border security, refugees, and Jerusalem against the backdrop right. of what is a very nasty and quite grim and depressing regional story.
Well, quickly before we go, there's a narrative, though, on the "no, we can't" rhetoric that the Israeli press is characterizing Netanyahu as bringing to Washington. There's a narrative for the Prime Minister of Israel that no matter how much of a hard line you begin with, even if you're Ariel Sharon, you end up, or Ehud Olmert, you end up endorsing a two-state solution. It seems to me that Netanyahu can't really be terribly coy about, "I'm not going to go there," when everyone before him and arguably more hard-line leaders adopted that position. He's going to have to get there eventually.
It's true. And remember, the history of peacemaking in Israel is not a history of doves talking the talk. It's a history from Begin, even to Rabin, to Shamir, to Sharon, and to Netanyahu in his first incarnation, of hawks walking the walk. So you're absolutely right. That's the key question. And whether or not Benjamin Netanyahu is prepared in his own mind to be the Israeli prime minister that presides over the creation of a Palestinian state and a division of Jerusalem and the return to June 67 borders is very much right now an open question.
Well, my guest, Aaron David Miller, former advisor on the Middle East to both the Republican and Democratic secretaries of state. He's the author of The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, commenting on the meeting today between Barack Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel. Thank you, Aaron David Miller. And now, Femi Okay has the headlines.
Thank you very much, John. The time is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. There have been at least five aftershocks in the LA area after a 4.7 magnitude quake jolted the city last night. That earthquake was centered about 10 miles southwest of downtown LA, and it lasted 10 to 15 seconds. Windows shattered across downtown, but no major injuries reported so far. Firefighters say that they have contained a fireball at an oil refinery in Delaware after an explosion last night. The explosion at a Sunoco oil refinery in Claymont, Delaware, rattled homes, but nobody was injured. Company officials say that some production units were affected, but they're working with other refineries to meet demand. In international news, the Sri Lankan government says that it has defeated the Tamil Tiger rebels in the country's north and killed their leader. There's no independent confirmation of that, but we have spoken with Robert Blake. He's the U.S. ambassador to Sri Lanka, and he says there are more than 300,000 people living in aid camps there after being displaced by the fighting. And share prices in India jumped 17% in the first day of trading since the governing Congress coalition won the general election. That's a look at your news for now. John, Andrea.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Andrea Bernstein.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Karina Longworth now joins us, film critic and editor of Spout Blog, daily film culture blog that's part of Spout.com, a social networking site for movie lovers. And you're in Cannes, right, Karina?
Yes, I am.
So make me jealous. What do you see and what's the buzz?
Well, everybody is really excited about this French film called A Prophet, which is directed by Jacques Audiard. He had a film a few years ago called The Beat That My Heart Skipped, which was essentially a remake of James Toback's Fingers. And A Prophet follows a young Muslim criminal who enters a prison and gets tied up with the Italian mafia there and then eventually takes them over.
And at Cannes this year, in the middle of some turmoil in the American film industry where audiences are up but the production of films is way, way down, what is the sort of sense on the street of the American directors that the French audiences and the European audiences are most interested in?
Well, going into the festival, people were very excited about Taking Woodstock, which is the new film by Ang Lee, and also Inglourious Basterds, which is the new film from Quentin Tarantino. That one hasn't screened yet, so the anticipation is still high, but Taking Woodstock screened a few days ago, and reaction has been pretty dismal.
Really?
It has a few fans, but in general, especially coming on the heels of his last film, Brokeback Mountain, people are pretty disappointed.
Well, listen to a little clip from the Quentin Tarantino flick, and we can talk about that for a moment. Again, you're saying that hasn't screened yet, but here's a preview.
Members of the National Socialist Party conquered Europe through murder, torture, intimidation, and terror. And that's exactly what we're going to do to them. We will be cruel to the Germans. And through our cruelty, they will know who we are.
Well, sounds like another, you know, family flick from Quentin Tarantino, huh, Karina?
Right. That's Brad Pitt as a Nazi hunter and the head of a group of Jewish American soldiers who go out looking to scalp Nazis.
And it's just, and it isn't even the most violent movie that's being screened there. Tell us about Antichrist.
Antichrist screened yesterday, and in general, the press is appalled. It's the new film by Lars von Trier, who made Dogville, Breaking the Waves, Dancer in the Dark. And it stars Charlotte Gainsbourg and Willem Dafoe as a couple who go a little mad after their son dies. And it's extremely violent, extremely graphic sexually. People here are saying that there's absolutely no way it can be released in the version that's screened here. Some people really like it, though. but there was a lot of laughter during the press screening and even some booing.
Well, I'm looking forward to Terry Gilliam's coming back with Heath Ledger's last film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Heath Ledger actually died during the shooting of the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. And he was replaced by three actors, Johnny Depp, Colin Farrell, and Jude Law.
Wow.
And this film hasn't screened yet either, but a few people have seen it in market screenings, and apparently the three replacement actors play a version of Heath Ledger's character in what seem to be dream sequences. The consensus is that the film is beautifully made, but that, like many recent Terry Gilliam movies, it's kind of a mess and doesn't really hold together.
Yeah, sometimes it's the mess that I like the most, but that doesn't make it commercially successful. Well, Karina, have a great time in Cannes. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Karina Longworth is a film critic and editor of Spout Blog, daily film culture blog that's part of Spout.com, talking about the Cannes Film Festival all this week.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. Find out if you're on the right side of a possible mass extinction right after headlines from Femi Okay.
Coming to you at almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama's first meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is later this morning. The Obama administration supports an independent Palestinian state alongside Israel. And not so Netanyahu, at least not publicly. But it's worth keeping an eye on his position over the weekend. His defense minister said that Netanyahu may soon back a two-state plan. Notre Dame graduates now have their diplomas in hand after a memorable graduation. President Obama's presence there brought out anti-abortion demonstrators.
We're fine, everybody.
Protesters criticized the Catholic school for inviting a pro-choice president to speak at commencement. The president didn't shy away from the controversy in his speech, calling for people to find common ground. And there were sporadic protests inside the arena amid cheers for President Obama. In international news, Afghan police say that local soldiers killed three civilians when they opened fire in a market in eastern Afghanistan. The suspects are now in custody while police investigate. Civilian deaths have recently become a bigger issue in the country. And all this happens as President Hamid Karzai's brother is lucky to be alive after an apparent assassination attempt today. His brother is also a politician. The trial of pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi is underway at a prison in Myanmar. The Asian nation is also known as Burma. Myanmar's military government charges her with violating her house arrest terms after an American man swam to her lakeside home. Her lawyers say that she has no connection to the visitor and the military leaders are just using it as an excuse to keep her locked up. Suu Kyi was scheduled to go free later this month after 6 years of house arrest. Myanmar watchers expect the generals to extend her sentence. And that is a look at stories making headlines this morning. John, Andrea.
Thanks, Bemi. We're talking this morning about the possibility of a mass extinction, and we want to know what species are you most worried about going away? And do you take any precautions to keep them around? Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE with yours or email mytake@thetakeaway.org. Many biologists believe we're in the middle of what's called the sixth extinction. It's the idea that for the sixth time in the history of the Earth, we're experiencing a devastating mass die-off of many different species. Some scientists predict that half the ones now living on Earth could be gone by the end of this century. Elizabeth Colbert has a piece about it in this week's New Yorker. Good morning.
Good morning, Andrea.
I open up my New Yorker, I see an article by you, and I know it's going to be one in the series of Alaska is melting, the oceans are dying. Now it's mass extinction. What is the evidence that we're in the middle of a mass extinction?
Well, it's scientists look at extinction in sort of as sort of coming in two types, I suppose you would say. And one is sometimes referred to as background extinction. We just have there's just always a certain sort of like background noise. There's always a certain background rate of extinction. Species tend to have a certain lifetime on Earth, and we can establish that from the fossil record. And they compare, you know, how many species you would expect to go extinct in the, you know, relatively brief period that we've been studying this phenomenon to how many are actually going extinct. And you see that the numbers are, you know, way off the chart, you know, thousands of times, tens of thousands of times in some cases of some organisms, higher than the background rate.
Some of those, you mentioned frogs and bats. Maybe it's better to be a zebra mussel this day. Tell us about frogs and bats.
Well, both frogs and bats are experiencing massive population crashes right now. Frogs, about a third of all amphibians are considered threatened with extinction. And in both cases, interestingly enough, perhaps coincidentally, the immediate cause of this problem seems to be a fungus, a pathogen that was introduced into their world and to which they have no defenses.
So are you saying that sort of humans are a catastrophic event, kind of like an asteroid was for the dinosaurs?
Well, many people have made that comparison. There was a conference a couple years ago at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, which was called Humans and Other Catastrophes. So, you know, many people have made the analogy between humans, right, exactly, and the asteroid that ended the Cretaceous 65 million years ago.
But, Elizabeth, I mean, is it possible that asteroid is maybe too extreme of a metaphor in the sense that there are all kinds of infestations on the Earth, and maybe humans are an infestation that is causing a species die-off, in which case there may be analogs?
Well, it's absolutely possible. I mean, I think many biologists would say we're not necessarily in the middle of the sixth mass extinction. That's the sixth sort of great mass extinction, but we are. There have been many lesser extinction events, you know, scattered throughout the geological record that were a much more minor extinction event. But I think everyone would agree that we are an extinction event that will stand out, you know, when if you were to come back a million years ago, many millions of years ago, and look through the geological record, you know, at what was fossilized before we got here and what came after, you would tell that we were here from that record.
Well, the idea that humans are sort of against the Earth is something that's found its way into popular culture, and even one of our listeners has a comment on this. I listen to these two clips of tape, which actually go together, Elizabeth, and I want to get your comment.
I'm worried about the human race being extinct by the end of this century.
Human beings are a disease, a cancer of this planet. You are a plague.
So there's the Matrix and one of our listeners raising the same issue.
Well, I'm not going to, you know, really speculate on the future of the human race. You know, it's quite possible that humans will be here for a very long time and that, you know, other species are what we really have to worry about. There certainly are people who would question, you know, how much of the biosphere you can lose before you lose, you know, services, I guess what we would call them, biological services that humans depend on. My piece really doesn't doesn't go into that question, which is a very, very interesting question. And the idea of people being against, you know, the world, people are obviously, we are organisms that evolved, you know, just like every other organism on the earth. We just happen to have very powerful effects on the rest of the world that affect other creatures, sometimes very adversely. Sometimes, as Andrea mentioned, you know, we bring things around the world and they thrive. Zebra mussels are a very good example, but zebra mussels have driven a lot of other organisms that used to occupy that ecological niche, you know, into oblivion.
Elizabeth, is this just sort of another part of modern life that is destructive to the planet? I mean, you're so tied in with global warming that when I see your warming, when I see your byline, I think that this is going to be some other ancillary effect of global warming. But is there something else going on here?
Well, as the piece goes into, you know, we've had a pretty devastating effect on places that we spread into a long, long time ago when people first began to hit different parts of the world. The Hawaiian Islands, for example, are a very good example.
You're talking about forever as in the beginning of human history.
Right, exactly. Exactly. As humans moved around the world, you know, starting many thousands of years ago, they got their...
We've been a plague since we began.
Well, there's something literally called first contact extinction. I mean, that's a phenomenon when people move into a place, and it's particularly striking on, as I say, on islands. There's almost, you know, invariably a wave of extinctions at that moment. Now, what we're going through now is, you know, ratcheted up by the fact that there are so many of us and the fact that we are so technologically powerful. And global warming is a part of that. When people do these predictions of, you know, what's going to be around at the end of this century, and they talk about, you know, if current trends continue. Well, if current trends continue, the climatic zones that organisms live in now will be, you know, vastly different by the end of the century, and the oceans will also have changed. The ocean chemistry is changing in very dramatic ways, ways that it has not changed for millions of years as a result of the CO2 that's in the air being dissolved in the water and making the oceans more acidic. So we are causing changes right now that I don't think people appreciate the full extent of them. They're very dramatic if you look at what has happened even over geological time. You know, we are a force on a geological scale.
All right. Thanks very much. New Yorker writer Elizabeth Colbert with the Grim Reaper News of the Week. Thanks a lot.
Gotta love humans. Nice to meet you. Now, go extinct,
now
won't
dead.
You? Yes, indeed. One listener chimed in about the species he's not worried about.
I am not worried about the extinction of humankind. I personally, yes. I mean, I love my family and friends, but I think humankind is a blight on the planet, given our atrocious record of stewardship.
Man, humans are having some problems this morning on The Takeaway.
I just think that human beings and our arrogance and feelings of superiority, we just bowl everything over. We do what we want to do. We need to think more globally, and we need to think about the effects on other things when we do something.
Because we're superior. Hello. 877-8 my take, your notions on mass extinction, or the takeaway.org. Yes, indeed. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Andrea Bernstein.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
It's a tasty job for a tough opponent.
I can think of no more important assignment.
Barack Obama sends the former co-chair of the McCain campaign, Utah Governor Jim Huntsman, to China. New rule, if you beat them, send them to the State Department. Just ask Hillary Clinton about that. Are we trying to stir things up? Of course. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Stirring things up. Good morning. It's Monday, May 18th. I'm John Hockenberry, joined by The Takeaway's very own.
Just keep chasing pavements.
Andrea Bernstein. Normally she's chasing pavements for us, tracking the stimulus package, but she's here co-hosting. Good morning.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, we'll talk to an urban planner with an innovative plan to recycle the empty lots of shuttered Chrysler and GM dealerships. Plus, we'll talk with America's man in Sri Lanka on the fast-moving developments in the civil war there. These stories and plenty more coming up, but first these headlines.
And in the headlines, President Obama meets with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu next hour. Their first meeting could highlight some sharp differences. The Obama administration supports an independent Palestinian state next to Israel. Netanyahu has yet to publicly back the two-state plan. The president took on the abortion issue in a controversial speech at Notre Dame graduation yesterday. He urged people on both sides of the debate to look for common ground. Protests went on outside, but the crowd in the hall was largely polite, although a handful of anti-abortion protesters tried to disrupt the speech. Grads flashed both pro-Obama and anti-abortion messages. Andrea?
Democracy activist Aung San Suu Kyi is on trial in Myanmar, the Asian nation also known as Burma. Myanmar's military government charges her with violating house arrest terms after an American man swam to her lakeside home. Her lawyers say she's no connection to the visitor. Critics say the generals will pounce on any excuse to keep her locked up. Here's British diplomat Bill Rammel.
We're very concerned. I think the arrest of Aung San Suu Kyi is very disturbing and bluntly wrong, and it suggests that the Burmese regime is intent on finding any pretext, no matter how tenuous, to extend her unlawful detention.
Suu Kyi was scheduled to go free later this month after years in captivity. Myanmar watchers expect the generals to extend her sentence. Elsewhere in Asia, Sri Lanka's government claims the leader of the Tamil Tiger rebels is dead. The army says troops defeated the rebels in the country's north, killing the leader along with top deputies. There's no way to know for sure yet, as reporters are barred from the battle zone.
The earth is moving in Southern California. They're still feeling aftershocks in L.A. this morning after a 4.7 magnitude earthquake hit late last night. So far, injuries and damage are light. The whole region shook last night with tremors felt as far south as Long Beach. Oil refinery on the Delaware River now under control. Sunoco facility along the Pennsylvania-Delaware border rattled nearby homes when it blew up late last night. There are apparently no injuries. India's stock market burned so hot they had to halt trading today. A key index there rocketed up 17% after the election on Saturday. The Congress Party won. Japan's Nikkei sank about 2.5%. Hong Kong and South Korean markets posted gains today. And on Wall Street later this hour, the Dow starts at 8268, the S&P at 882. Futures trading suggests a flat to positive opening. Andrea talked about it a moment ago. Auto dealerships all across the country are going away. What should replace them? What can we build on those acres and acres of parking lots? An ARC project? Water park? Demolition derby? Skateboard? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your suggestions or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Well, I'm really overjoyed because we have been expecting for this since the day I was born. I have been living with the war. I was born with the war. I was living with the war. And I never wanted to die with the war.
That woman speaking to a BBC reporter in Colombo, Sri Lanka, describing a moment that, in fact, is not joyful for everyone in that country. The government says it has totally defeated the Tamil Tigers after a quarter century of war. A military spokesman said in a special television broadcast that all of the territory previously held by the rebels has now been taken by the Sri Lankan army. And the army is reporting that it has killed the leader of the Tigers, Velupele Prabhakaran, although there has been no independent confirmation of that claim. Joining us now from Colombo to give us a sense of what's actually going on the ground and the significance of this issue that both the president and the secretary of state have made statements about as recently as last week is Ambassador Robert Blake. Robert Blake has been ambassador to Sri Lanka and the Maldives since September 2006. President Obama recently nominated him to serve as Assistant Secretary of State for South and Central Asian Affairs. First of all, Ambassador, what is the situation? I mean, is the war actually over at this point?
The Sri Lankan military has achieved a very important milestone. As of today, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam no longer control any territory in Sri Lanka for the first time in more than 20 years. And as you said earlier, the the government has also announced that all of the senior leadership of the LTT, including its leader Prabhakaran, have been killed, although we do not yet have independent confirmation of that. But at the same time, there's a very deep sadness in the Tamil community because of the trauma that they have suffered. Most of the population of the northern province, which is overwhelmingly Tamil and was previously controlled by the LTT, has been displaced over the last 2 years of fighting, and there are now more than 300,000 internally displaced people in IDP camps. So Sri Lanka today is a country that is very deeply divided, and it is now important for the country to begin urgently the process of healing and reconciliation so that they can turn the page on this bloody and violent past and build a new Sri Lanka.
Ambassador, what is the U.S. role here? With the Congress Party winning a decisive victory, it would appear, in India, India, which has normally been the broker in this conflict, is now free to re-enter. Is the U.S., along with India, a possible broker here for what the future may hold for this very, very tense situation between these two ethnic groups?
The United States has long been involved in peace efforts here in Sri Lanka. We are a member of what's called the co-chairs, which are a donor group that was set up after a donor conference in Tokyo several years ago. And we are part of that group along with the EU and Norway. The Indians are not part of that group, but we consult very closely with them. And all of us have been calling for years now for a political solution to this conflict, and we continue to call for a political solution. Just because the LTT no longer controls territory, they remain a very significant factor. They have a large fundraising network overseas. They have a large network of sleeper cells around the country who have the ability to strike at any time. So a political solution remains very important to bring a true end to this conflict.
If you are confirmed, what do you make of the significance of the Indian election and the outcome that we learned on Saturday before we go?
Well, I think that the Indian election is very, very important. We've had very good relations with Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. He staked his election campaign on good relations with the United States. And as you know, we concluded recently a civil nuclear deal with his government. And I think one of the most important relationships for us in the 21st century will be to cement our strategic partnership with our Indian friends. And President Obama has said that India is going to be a very important partner in addressing the global challenges we face and will be a global power for the rest of this century.
Well, you'll certainly be involved in all of that. Ambassador Robert Blake, ambassador to Sri Lanka and the Maldives since September 2006 and subject to Senate confirmation, who will be returning to Washington, possibly to serve as Assistant Secretary of State for South and Central Asian Affairs. Thank you, Ambassador. Andrea?
President Barack Obama has appointed Utah Republican Governor John Huntsman as his ambassador to China. Here's Obama speaking from the White House on Saturday.
I can think of no more important assignment than creating the kinds of bridges between our two countries that will determine the well-being not just of Americans and Chinese, but also the future of the world.
But some say the appointment is also a politically savvy move that will ensure Republican moderate Huntsman is out of the running as a candidate for the 2012 presidential election. Is this the case, as one Republican strategist says, of keeping your friends close and your enemies in China? We're here now with Politico reporter Alexander Burns. Good morning. Why choose Governor Huntsman? What are his credentials?
Well, in a lot of ways, even politics aside, Governor Huntsman is a very logical choice for this job. He's a former ambassador to Singapore. He's a member of the LDS Church and serves his Mormon mission in East Asia, so he speaks Mandarin Chinese. He has a strong business background, so he's well-versed in issues of finance and trade that are going to be important for any ambassador to China. But like you just mentioned, he's also a leading voice of sort of moderation in the Republican Party and someone who David Plouffe, President Obama's former campaign manager, has pointed to as a potential threat for the future.
Nevertheless, he seems a little bit surprised by this appointment.
I never expected to be standing here under the inquisitive gaze of George Washington and equally inquisitive gaze of my wife. Nor did I expect, as national co-chair of Senator McCain's presidential campaign, to be called into action by the person who beat us.
So the national co-chair of Senator McCain's presidential campaign, despite this clip, the Obama administration's had a little bit of difficulty getting Republicans to accept its appointments, haven't they?
Well, they have. You know, the president has took a historic step in keeping Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense. And certainly has tried to bring Republicans on in other ways as well. He had has a Republican at the Department of Transportation, obviously tried and
yes,
was not successful.
The well-known Republican Ray LaHood.
Right, exactly. he had a slightly greater success when he got Judge Gregg to accept the job of Commerce Secretary. Unfortunately, Senator Gregg then changed his mind, decided not to follow through. Unfortunately, that is for the White House. So for Governor Huntsman, this is a sort of lateral move for Governor Huntsman, but it's a big move for the White House in terms of being able to bring on a real Republican heavyweight into a job that's not necessarily a huge promotion.
So was Huntsman actually preparing to run in 2012?
Well, he had started talking to big Republican consultants in Washington. He was talking to John Weaver, former McCain campaign official, both McCain 2000 and McCain 2008. He had done the sort of Washington media circuit when he was in town for the National Governors Association meeting and then for the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So he was looking and sounding like a candidate. And unlike your typical governor of Utah, you know, which is not a particularly large or prominent state, he was speaking
or,
out
or particularly blue.
Right, or particularly competitive in any way. He was speaking out on national issues, which is not something that he had to do, taking positions on gay rights and global warming, which really put him at odds with his own constituency.
So we got any moderates left in the GOP now?
Well, folks also point to Charlie Crist, who's running for Senate in Florida, as someone of a with a sort of Huntsman-like profile in terms of saying, let's not focus so much on the social issues, let's focus on economic issues and try to find common ground with the administration. But, you know, the Republican Party has a sort of long conversation with itself ahead, and taking Huntsman out of the picture in some ways is less significant for the fact that it removes him from the 2012 election as a candidate, and more that it just removes him as a voice from a conversation that the party increasingly recognizes that it needs to have.
Is he going to be a good ambassador? I mean, what does it say about U.S.-China policy, which is maybe what we should really be talking about?
Well, I think an interesting question, given Huntsman's prominence and given his sort of heavy political credentials that he brings to the ambassadorship, is how is he going to be cooperating with other members of the administration, since the China portfolio is not something that the ambassador gets to deal with exclusively. He'll have to figure out who's really in the driver's seat when it comes to dealing with China, him or Hillary Clinton, Tim Geithner, any of the many members of the administration who would, I think, like to see themselves as real China hands.
It would certainly seem to signal it's not going to be a radical change in China policy. Politico reporter Alexander Burns, thanks very much for talking to us about the new ambassador to China, John Huntsman, the Republican governor of Utah.
Sounds like he's saying not only John Huntsman can go to China. It could be Geithner or Hillary Clinton.
We'll have a party there in a parking lot.
Indeed. Auto dealerships all across the country, those parking lots are going away, and that's going to leave acres and acres of open lots that could be redeveloped in all sorts of ways. We're going to talk about it shortly. What would you like to do with all that space?
This is Rusty Beaton from Detroit, Michigan, and I think that what we could do with every single last one of those closed down car dealerships is, well, make them into farms. It'll keep people out of retirement and keep food on our plates.
Take parking lots and put up a paradise at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
CIA Director Leon Panetta gives his first speech as CIA Director today at a policy luncheon in California. His remarks happened to come just after a dust-up with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi about whether she was truthfully briefed about waterboarding techniques. Pelosi says she wasn't, but Panetta's defending the spy agency. The fight also drew in Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, who came to Pelosi's defense. Panetta, Pelosi, and Feinstein all hail from Northern California, and they all have an interesting and not always happy history together. We're here with Carolyn Lockhead, the San Francisco Chronicle's Washington correspondent. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Caroline, tell us about the relationship between Speaker Pelosi and CIA Director Panetta. Friends? Enemies? Frenemies?
Well, friends. I mean, think about it. San Francisco is kind of a small town. He served as a member of Congress from Monterey for many, many years. They used to have weekly dinners as members of the California delegation. So their ties go way back. Politically, they're not close at all because Panetta is much more moderate, almost a conservative Democrat. Pelosi is seen as one of the more liberal members of the House, but definitely cordial and friendly.
So what should we expect today? He really kind of injected himself. I mean, you know, he was the one who created problems for Pelosi by going and defending the agency. Should we expect more of this today?
Well, you could say she created problems for him by being a little intemperate. But Panetta really, I think this is a little overplayed, his put down of Pelosi, because think about it. He had to come after she accused the CIA of lying. He's the new director of the CIA trying to establish credibility. He had to come to his agency's defense. I mean, that's he would have undermined himself terribly had he not done that.
One of the things that's kind of interesting to me about this discussion is that, the CIA, and we're talking modern history, hasn't always had the best record of truth-telling.
You could say they're professional untruth-tellers.
They're misleaders.
That's what they do. And it was interesting because Feinstein, on Thursday, when I asked her about Pelosi, she said, look, I lived two houses down from her for many years. I've never known her not to tell the truth. Now, you can say a lot about Pelosi, but lying is just not really part of her M.O.
Now, how about Feinstein and Pelosi? I mean, I know sometimes when people are, you know, sort of politically seem close, sometimes they really hate each other. They're very competitive. They undermine each other behind the scenes. How about Feinstein and Pelosi?
Well, as I said, they lived a couple of houses down from each other in San Francisco for many, many years. It's a small world, San Francisco politics. Feinstein, remember, was the mayor of San Francisco at one point.
That doesn't necessarily mean they were friends,
no,
right? They could have, turned the other way when they were walking their dogs and whatnot.
Yes, but they're cordial, so they're running into each other all the time at fundraisers and in political circles.
But this is the mystery.
There's some rival. Always between powerful politicians.
But this is the mystery to me, Carolyn. Why wouldn't, and going back to Panetta for just a moment, why wouldn't Pelosi have given Panetta a call and said, hey, what gives here? It seems like there was no sort of back-channel communication here, that they're doing this all in the headlines, which surprises me for people who go back that far.
Well, Pelosi had been under fire for a week. She was over in the Middle East in Iraq for several days while Republicans were stirring this pot back in Washington with daily, challenges and charges and leaking the CIA timeline and so forth. So she went to her weekly press conference. That was not unusual. And felt that she simply had to respond.
Does she have any history do they have any history of any of the three of them, dust-ups with either Feinstein or Panetta, or Panetta and Feinstein?
There's been talk in the past that of some friction between Panetta and Feinstein, because Feinstein, basically, if she wants it, she could be California governor. And at one point, she delayed deciding whether or not she was going to do that and sort of put through cold water on Panetta's bid by waiting too long so that he couldn't raise money to get in the race.
Carolyn,
but that's just strictly rumor.
You said that you think that this question of sort of the personal and professional relationships is obscuring a larger issue. What is that issue?
Well, this dust-up with Pelosi is obscuring the whole fact that how did the United States of America come to embrace torture? if you think about it, that's a pretty shocking thing. There was a hearing on the Senate last week, none of which got any attention, really.
So do you think that, I mean, you know, the Republicans seem to have actually gotten a little bit of traction with their criticisms.
It's the first traction they've gotten since the election.
You think it's going to go anywhere?
They will do their very best to keep it going.
And what about Pelosi? An indication that she wants to keep it going, or does she want to put it behind her?
Oh, she definitely wants. She put out a statement after the Panetta letter Friday, really sort of toning things down quite a bit. Of course she wants to put it behind her. This is a critical juncture. She's the top captain for Obama to put health care through the House of Representatives this summer. She can't afford this distraction.
We'll see whether President Obama's CIA director Leon Panetta keeps it alive. Thanks very much, Carolyn Lockhead, San Francisco Chronicle, Washington correspondent.
So auto dealerships all across the country are going away, and that's going to leave acres and acres of pavement that could easily be redeveloped in all sorts of ways. Maybe not so easily. But what would you do with all that space? Shab Adel from Detroit writes to us, 2 years ago, a local dealer took over a donut shop on our block, and now, since this dealer may close, I want that nice donut shop back. Get your donut shop back. Give us a suggestion at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now Femi Okay has our headlines.
At 28 minutes past the hour, there have been at least five aftershocks in the L.A. area after 4.7 magnitude quake jolted the city last night. That earthquake was centered around about 10 miles southwest of downtown L.A., and it lasted 10 to 15 seconds. There are no reports of any major injuries. Firefighters say that they've contained a fireball at an oil refinery in Delaware after an explosion last night. The explosion at a Sunoco oil refinery in Claymont, Delaware.
Sunoco.
Rattled homes, but nobody was injured. Company officials say that some production units were affected, but they're working with other refineries to meet demand. Champion swimmer Michael Phelps wasn't feeling quite so champion after this weekend. He competed in Charlotte in his first competition since winning a record 8 golds at the Olympics. He entered 5 events but only won 2, and that's the first time that he's lost a final in almost a year.
Oh, he must have been really bummed.
And
I
in international,
really bummed by
sorry, didn't mean to interrupt
sorry,
you there, John.
Excuse me.
Are you done, or will I be interrupting you further?
No, sorry.
Okay, thank you. Just put your bong away. In international news, a date has been set for the next general election in Iraq. The country's courts ruled today, setting the election date for January the 30th. That's about a month later than had been expected. More than 130,000 U.S. troops are expected to remain in the country until after the election. And that's a look at your news, John.
Thank you, Femi. So bong in here.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Auto dealerships all across the country are going away, and that's going to leave acres and acres of open lots that could be redeveloped in all sorts of ways. What would you do with all that space? Community garden?
Hi, this is Sally from Waterford. I believe that the GM or Chrysler dealerships should become centers for recycling and sustainability.
Michael Phelps Gold Medal Museum? Call us at 877-MY-TAKE with yours, or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
So yesterday, there were two Game 7s in the NBA playoffs. The Boston Celtics and the Orlando Magic played Game 7 last night. The Celtics couldn't pull it out. And the Lakers played the Houston Rockets, and it was definitely no contest there. But let's begin with the Boston Celtics. The defending champs were playing on fumes last night.
We've been in that situation many a times where we make a run and we win the game. Tonight, it just really felt like we ran out of gas. For us to be only down 5 and to lose the way we did, I really can't pinpoint it on anything else.
That's Celtics forward Paul Pierce talking about the game that they lost in the end, Game 7. Joining us now is our Takeaway Sports contributor and friend Ibrahim Abdelmateen right here in the studio. Ibrahim, the Celtics really couldn't get it done. It seems to me the Bulls took all the gas out of them and that they really couldn't face a deeper Orlando Magic team.
Their legs seemed a little tired. You're right. Doc Rivers breaks every single huddle with the Celtics with this principle, the South African principle called Ubuntu. So every time they break the huddle, they say Ubuntu, which means collective struggle. And I think that that carried them for a year and almost 2 years, and it just wasn't enough.
And without Kevin Garnett, I mean, what can you do?
It's true. He was a major defensive presence. If he had been in there against Dwight Howard, it would have been a completely different series. I don't think it would. It may not have had a different result, but it would have been a different series.
Standouts for the Magic going forward.
Definitely guys like J.J. Redick, Mikhail Petras, and their star Hedo Turkoglu. They have a very international lineup. They can rain threes, and you crowd guys around Dwight Howard, and then they punch the ball out to get those three-point shooters. If those guys can knock down shots, then they have a chance against the Cavs.
This is a real three-point shooting threat team. Is it a hot-cold team where sometimes they're up, sometimes they're down?
That's what it looked like in this series. I mean, they had some moments when they just weren't shooting the ball really well, and I think that speaks to the length of the playoffs, like we were talking about earlier, where these guys, they're going through this grueling process. Some days you just don't have the legs, and you got to really get in there to get a good three-point shot in.
Three-point teams are streaky. Talk about the Lakers. They've just trounced the Rockets.
Yeah, it was they basically were like, we're in LA, we're going to make this happen.
Yeah.
In the beginning of the game, the national anthem was played, and when the Rockets' red glare was said over the loudspeaker, the Lakers fans booed. It's probably the only place in America where that could possibly happen.
Yeah.
I think the Lakers were out for blood yesterday.
Oops.
So the Lakers move on to the team you called the strongest team in the NBA right now.
I love the Denver Nuggets. They're a bunch of rangy guys. You got Nene, the Brazilian star, and you have Anderson, who they call Birdman, who's got his little mohawk. Those guys going against Gasol and Bynum in the middle is going to be like a real tough, brutal, physical series.
And the next challenge for LeBron?
What challenge? No, I think right now, actually, the Magic actually have beaten them in the season series.
So. Yeah, I should say, the Orlando Magic goes up against the Cleveland Cavaliers and LeBron James. You know, we're getting so inside basketball here. It's just, we're taking layups.
Completely. I think, what they're saying, the Magic were the best team to play Cleveland at this round. They have the best chance to beat them. So they match up the most effectively. So this should be a very physical, very tough, well-executed basketball. And it should be a good basketball to watch.
So I got two words for you. Rachel Alexandra.
Rachel Alexander.
What an exciting race.
And what a name. Sounds like a bar mitzvah or something.
Or Russian royalty or something like that.
So you want a Philly to get that far. And if it's the first time a Philly's run since 1999, the first time since 1924.
85 years, yes, indeed.
Correct. And then, of course, you got Calvin Burrell with a shot at a personal jockey triple crown if he can do it.
That's unusual. And, you know, the way he was talking about this horse, that if it ever ran in a triple crown race, whatever happened, he would get on that horse. Is Rachel Alexandra really as much of a legend as, he's talking about?
That's a good question. I think when you look at the at any given moment, these horses could be good or bad. And I think probably, yeah.
But she's bred for stamina. She's bred for strength and stamina. Not like we were talking last week about the breeding. Yeah. That's new.
It definitely is new, and I think it's going to take over the sport.
So, Ibrahim, soon it's going to be summer. Basketball season's going to be over. Horse racing season's going to be over. What are those of us with ADD going to do?
Well, hopefully you'll do like all the kids in between the two games yesterday. There was two games, and all the kids, if you looked outside, they flooded the streets, and they were playing and mimicking their best moves. So I encourage everybody to get out there and actually play a sport and do, one of these things that you're so interested in.
Well, the great thing is when it's playoff time and the weather is great, you do definitely get people out on the streets in the afternoons between the games.
It's true.
Sure.
The one thing I wanted to say is that I lament the passing of the Rockets. Aaron Brooks was the lightest player in the NBA. He was the most electrifying player. And I also lament the passing of the Celtics. They had the heart of a champion.
The passing? It sounds like they died.
And I think, yes.
Well, to some on our staff, in fact, that's the way they feel.
They're
any predictions? You got a prediction?
Today.
Well, I'm definitely going with Denver in the west side, and I'm going with Cleveland from the east.
So Denver-Cleveland, that's
yes,
your
sir.
Prediction.
That's my prediction.
We shall see. So no Kobe LeBron.
Well, Not this year. How
about Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Thanks so much. Racking up the NBA playoffs on a Monday morning. I'll let you know you can learn more about the five keys that will decide who wins the NBA Finals. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen has written his full analysis on thetakeaway.org. Femi Okay has some more headlines.
Thank you very much. There are mixed signals from Israel ahead of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's meeting with President Obama at the White House today. Two top Israeli leaders say that Prime Minister Netanyahu could be ready to back a two-state plan for Israelis and Palestinians. But another senior aide says he might not yield to pressure from President Obama. The White House strongly supports a two-state solution. And President Obama jumped into another controversy yesterday when he gave the graduation address at Notre Dame. Amid protests, he used the platform to talk about abortion, saying there is a middle ground on the issue. Protesters interrupted the president's speech and 37 people were arrested for trespassing. In international news, the Sri Lankan government says that it's defeated the Tamil Tiger rebels and killed their leader. There's no independent confirmation of that, but the US State Department says that more than 300,000 people are living in aid camps after being displaced by the fighting. Afghan police say that local soldiers have killed three civilians when they opened fire in a market in eastern Afghanistan. The suspects are now in custody while police investigate. And meanwhile, the brother of Afghan President Hamid Karzai escaped on apparent assassination attempt today as gunmen fired rockets and machine guns at his motorcade. Wali Karzai is the president of the Provincial Council of the Southern Kandahar Province. And that is a look at some stories making headlines this morning.
Sounds like he's lucky to be alive.
Definitely lucky.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Andrea Bernstein.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Today could be the end of the line for a 25-year struggle in Sri Lanka between the rebel group the Tamil Tigers and the Sri Lankan government. State television in Sri Lanka said the supreme leader of the Tamil Tiger rebels, or the LTTE, Velupalai Prabhakaran, has been killed by government forces fighting in the north of the country, and it's been escalating in recent weeks and caught thousands of civilians in the fierce fighting. Well, today marks an important moment in Sri Lankan history. A quarter century of fighting has come to a close, but not everyone is overjoyed. We spoke earlier with Manivanan Tiramuli, head of the BBC's Tamil service, who joined us from London.
Obviously, the Tamil Tigers supporters and the hardcore people who wanted a solution militarily would possibly not be overjoyed. But this is a very important event, very watershed kind of an event in the history of the ethnic conflict. The armed insurgency phase of the Tamil struggle for self-determination and their grievances seems to be over.
So does Velupalai Prabhakaran, the leader of the Tamil Tigers, does he embrace a kind of martyrdom here? And does he go on as a sort of a legend of the fight that was once lost? Or is this the end of the line for the militancy?
It seems to be the end of the line for the militancy. But as far as Prabhakaran's legend is concerned, only history will decide. But among his supporters and the section of the Tamil population, he will certainly become a folk hero who fought for them, much though his methods would have been controversial. And in spite of the flaws and deficiencies and shortcomings in the movement's methodology, the supporters would see him as a hero, definitely.
Now, there was talk over the weekend of mass suicides, that the civilian and humanitarian situation was reaching a critical stage. What have you managed to learn in a situation which can only be described as incredibly difficult to get confirmed information? nation.
Absolutely. This has been a war without witnesses, as the independent media access has been denied into the war area by the Sri Lankan government. So there has been no independent witnesses except for the occasional ICRC volunteers and UN workers. Other than that, there have been no independent witnesses. But or the weekend reports about mass suicides of cadres and civilians have not really proved right, because we haven't heard much about any mass suicides. There have definitely been civilian misery in the form of fleeing civilians and civilians getting killed by crossfire, but no mass suicide as such.
I imagine the expatriate communities of Tamils all around the world are really agonizing over the news reports. As you say, it's difficult to get any confirmed information. What's it been like in those communities around the world?
Very difficult. The diaspora community has been largely seen as the supporters of the Tamil Tiger movement. A significant section of the Tamil diaspora has been the financiers, you know, providing the financial oxygen for the movement. They have been emotionally involved supporting the movement, mainly because possibly they felt alienated from the Sri Lankan state because of the political grievances. So the end of the militant phase of the struggle would definitely be a disappointment for the diaspora.
And there's much political work left to be done in all quarters. My guest was Manivadhan Thiramuli, head of the BBC Tamil service, who earlier joined us this morning from London with that briefing on what appears to be the end of a quarter century of war between the Tamil Tigers and the Sri Lankan government.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Andrea Bernstein, and here's Femi Oke with the headlines.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. LA residents are getting fresh reminders of the danger of living in an earthquake zone. Aftershocks have rolled in this morning following a 4.7 magnitude quake late last night. The quake hit a few miles outside of LAX airport. The tremor was felt all the way to San Diego. At least 10 aftershocks have hit since then. An overnight disaster on the East Coast is now under control. Delaware firefighters say that they've got an oil refinery there contained, but it's still burning. The facility blew up late on Sunday, lighting up the night sky and rattling area houses. Nobody has been hurt, and the company can't check out the full damage until the fire burns out and it's safe to enter. In international news, India's stock market had to stop trading after a stunning 17% jump in the main index there. The reason for this was the ruling party's surprisingly strong showing in weekend elections. Staying in Asia, a top democracy activist is now on trial in Myanmar. The Asian nation is also known as Burma. The country's military rulers say that Aung San Suu Kyi violated her house arrest when an American man swam to her lakeside home and talked to her. Suu Kyi's lawyers say the man acted on his own. And finally, there's some new inductees to the Country Music Hall of Fame this morning. Roy Clark, Charlie McCoy, and Barbara Mandrell. I was listening to the Opry when all of my friends were digging rock and roll and rhythm and blues. I was country when country was a That's Barbara Mandrell singing I Was Country when country wasn't cool. In fact, they all were country before it was cool. Roy Clark and Charlie McCoy also. And they were honoured for their contributions for bringing country music to a mass audience through TV. And that is a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
Auto dealerships all across the country are going away, and that's going to leave acres and acres of open lots that could be redeveloped in all sorts of ways. What should be done with all that space? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with yours, or email mytake@thetakeaway.org.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Joni Mitchell came out with that song in 1970. 1970! Say it isn't so. But 2009 might be the year we take thousands of parking lots down and put up little bits of paradise. Maybe. This weekend, 1,100 auto dealership owners across the country took in the sobering news their contracts with GM are going away. And after they deal with the horrible reality of losing their employees and their livelihood, they'll also have to deal with what to do with their land. Many of these dealerships are owned by family businesses in cities or just beyond the city limits in the suburbs. So what can they do with that land? Ellen Dunham-Jones is director of the architecture program at Georgia Tech and co-author of Retrofitting Suburbia, Urban Design Solutions for Redesigning Suburbs. She joins us from the studios of Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Ellen Dunham-Jones, when I think of a car dealership, I think of a big old parking lot on a strip mall at the edge of town. As an urban planner, do you have an image in your head of how much asphalt we're talking about when we say 1,900 dealerships are on the chopping block right now, and we might see 3,600 closures by the time the auto restructuring is over?
We're talking about a lot of asphalt, that's for sure. The car dealerships actually range in size considerably. A lot of the older, smaller dealerships are about 3 to 4 acres, just about the size of a typical Manhattan, New York City block. So that gives you some perspective of what could be built there. Many of the suburban dealerships are, the somewhat newer ones, are more like 7 to 10 acres and could easily be redeveloped into about 3 or more blocks. And larger auto malls often are up to 15, 25 acres, large enough for us to build an entire new mixed-use neighborhood.
Auto malls must be what I have in mind. Now, are they in ideal locations for mixed-use neighborhoods? I mean, they seem to be sort of out on the fringe of things, and that seems to be the kind of development that we're all supposed to be moving away from.
Well, they're actually located in a variety of places. And in fact, a lot of the older car dealerships already have been, over the last 10 years or so, have been reaching the point where they're in a relatively central location. They were built out at the edge, but development has leapfrogged them so many times.
Not
now.
Not the edge anymore.
Exactly. And so they're getting redeveloped. They've already, there's been a trend to sort of redevelop them and recognize that the land is now a lot more. It's worth building the parking garages and building up in greater density on these sites.
Well, it's interesting because last week they were saying that the rural dealers were maybe the stronger ones and that the ones closer into the cities were the ones that were likely to be saddled for closure. So maybe that does actually help the trend that you're talking about.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's always sad to see a business go under, but these closures really do present, I think, great opportunities for much more sustainable, less auto-oriented redevelopment.
Are you optimistic that that kind of discussion could happen? I mean, you know, in Atlanta, where you are, it seems that given a choice, that the choice seems to be not in the direction that you're advocating.
We certainly, Atlanta has that reputation, but in fact, we actually
do. Is it ill-deserved?
Yeah, we've been chopping down about 54 acres of trees a day out at the edges for much of the last decade.
Wow.
But we've also, there has been a real move to move closer into town, and the demographics are significantly changing, and people wanting to be in closer in locations. And redevelopments, whether it's car dealerships or other parking lot-oriented sites like dead malls, dead shopping centers, office parks. There's a lot of redevelopment going on here, more than you might think.
So what do you envision? I mean, for real, what do you see going into these dealerships in communities across America?
One really great example is that is adjacent to the Dadeland Mall in Kendall, Florida, about 9 miles outside of Miami. There was a 7.5-acre Cadillac dealership that was located within a, you know, just big sprawling area. But the whole area recently, transit arrived, and that triggered rezoning, and it has been redeveloped so that now that 7.5-acre parcel has 415 housing units and 8-story buildings with retail at the ground floor and pedestrian-friendly urban walkable blocks. It's both a symbolic victory of sort of walkable urbanism and transit-oriented urbanism over car culture, but it's also part of this larger movement that we document in our book, that June Williamson and I document in our book on retrofits.
So, I mean, given what's going on in the country now, the economics, the limited financing for housing, do you really see housing developments and transit springing up in these, you know, auto malls across the country?
Not in the short term. Certainly, until the credit crunch eases, there's not going to be a lot of that kind of ambitious redevelopment. I think in the short term, we're certainly going to see some adaptive reuse and re-inhabitation possibilities. We found many examples of other kinds of big box stores, not so different architecturally from an auto showroom, being adaptively reused into much more community-serving uses, such as libraries, schools, even churches. There's a car dealership in Washington, D.C. that was converted into an indoor dog park, and one in New Jersey that took advantage of the high bay repair areas for to put in an Olympic-sized swimming pool and become a health club.
So what is the process?
There's a lot of interesting proposals out there as well.
If somebody is, you know, if a dealership is closing down, I mean, does that auto dealer get to have control in the process, or does the community, or if somebody, you know, has made a suggestion today and they want to see their auto park turn into a water park or, you know, a composting heap or a community garden, what would they do?
Well, certainly these are private properties, and it is largely up to the owners how they want to handle their property. But it is also controlled largely by zoning. And what we're seeing in many communities is that whether it's retail sites or commercial sites, various kinds of commercial sites that are becoming more and more vacant, now is the time for communities to decide what do they really want to see happening on those sites and to change their zoning if they would prefer to see a mix of uses and higher densities.
What's your level of optimism that this is going to happen in the way that you hope it does?
I am actually quite optimistic.
Optimistic. That's always a good note to end on. Ellen Dunham-Jones is director of the architecture program at the Georgia Institute of Technology and co-author of Retrofitting Suburbia, Urban Design Solutions for Redesigning the Suburbs. Thanks very much.
Well, she's optimistic about some phenomena that are causing heartbreaks all over the country economically. There's going to be many open lots that could be redeveloped all sorts of ways. What do you do with those old car dealerships? Listeners in Michigan are letting us know.
I was thinking that depending on the size of the lot, they could be put greenhouses on them and do vegetable reduction.
Or another pastime.
I think they should take some of those car dealerships and turn them into drive-in movies, cheap movies, hire some young people to roll them out of those cases, serve them food and stuff.
I'm Andrea Bernstein.
And I'm John Huckenberry. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.